have to do some mathematical preparations before we launch right into quantum theory on kernel space. Namely, what we'll do is first we'll study functional derivatives and see what exactly they mean. We've already used them as if we knew what they were, but let's just see how they are, how they can properly be defined. And in the process, we'll see that they're not really mysterious. In fact, we can reduce them to ordinary derivatives. And then we'll study two examples of uses of the functional derivative. One will be an application to the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory that we've already had, but we'll just revisit it briefly now that we have the functional derivatives properly. And then second, and that's what we will really need here, is we will use the functional derivatives to define functional Legendre transform. Now, is everybody familiar with the regular Legendre transform? Everybody familiar with it? No? Oh, all right. Okay, so we'll do the Legendre transform and the functional Legendre transform. And using that, using functional derivatives, and using the functional Legendre transform, you will be able to move from the Hamiltonian formulation of a theory to its Lagrangian formulation. We will do that for quantum field theory. We will move from the Hamiltonian formulation, which is the Hamiltonian that is also in the quantum field theoretical Schrödinger equation. We move from that Hamiltonian formulation to a Lagrangian formulation of quantum field theory. And that will be the starting point for quantum field theory on curved space. And exactly how that strategy works, I will also show you today. So the overall outline of the rest of the course. So let's start with functional differentiation. For that purpose, let us remember how ordinary differentiation is defined. Ordinary differentiation was first discovered by Leibniz and Newton, and they defined the derivative of a function f of a variable u to be this Newton-Leibniz limit. We add a little bit to the variable, subtract the function, and the point without the division, and that difference is divided by the offset, and we let the offset go to zero. That same technique can be used to define the derivative of functions that have any number of variables, any countable number of variables. And the notation that you will use is this. The function f is a function of a number of variables, which we will enumerate u1, u2, u3, etc. And the notation would be that within brackets, we write the set of all the variables that this function depends on. Later on, this will allow us, this way of writing things would allow us to also put functions in here. So here we have a variable that depends on a discrete index j, and later we will have what you can think of as variables that depend on a continuous index, which you can also view as functions, of course. So the Newton-Leibniz derivative or partial derivative of a function of several variables is, of course, simply given by that limit here. And you see that I've put the Kronecker delta in here. The Kronecker delta adds a little offset to the argument, as it should do, but only to that variable that we are differentiating about. Okay, so there's a Kronecker delta ij. We're looking at all the variables enumerated by j, and the Kronecker delta ij makes sure that there's an offset only in the variable ui. And then the rest is just as usual. So we can write this out without a Kronecker delta, and it will look like this. Writing things in this way suggests how to generalize that to the case where
The function is a functional where f is mapping not just a discrete set of variables into a number, but a continuous set of variables or a function. So now we do the differentiation of functions of uncountably many variables. So capital F depends on variables u of x, and the x runs through Rn, for example. We can also view this as saying that capital F depends on a function u of x. So the functional derivative of that function with respect to the variable u of y is then defined in a very analogous fashion to how we defined the Newton-Leibniz limit for functions of countably many variables. Namely, we write it as the functional with the argument having an offset, but the offset only happening in that value here, it's the y, that corresponds to the variable with which we are, with respect to which we are differentiating. This is what used to be the Kronecker delta up there. Now it's a Dirac delta function. Other than that, it's the same thing. Since we are differentiating a functional, that is a mapping of functions into numbers, u is a function, f of u is a number, in general a number, a complex number. That's why it is called a functional derivative. It's a derivative of a functional. Now obviously that looks dangerous here, but we see that it's not that bad. In fact, it's not something extra. It can be derived from regular differentiation. But first, let's do an example. Consider a functional f of u, which is defined in this way. So what it does is it takes an arbitrary function u. We don't specify exactly what the function space is, but it's going to have to be functions over the real line, let's say. So this thing takes as input a function, and as output it will give you a number. What number is that? Well, you take the function and square it, multiply with the cosine of x, and integrate over all reals. Just as an example. The action in a quantum field theory can look like this, for example, as we will soon see. So the functional derivative then of f with respect to u of y is by the above definition that limit here. Limit of 1 over the offset. And then we have here the functional. See, I just wrote down the functional again, except that I added the offset. So it's a functional of the variable u, and wherever u of x is, I replaced it by u of x plus epsilon times what would have been the Kronecker delta in the discrete case. And it's got to be squared because this is a u squared. And here we have just the functional again. Now let's see what that is. We write out what exactly this square is, and we obtain three terms, of course, u of x squared. You obtain 2 epsilon u of x delta function, and you obtain epsilon squared delta function squared. And from this, we obtain a u of x squared. I pulled an overall factor of cosine of x in front of everything, because everything is an integral over cosine of x times something. Now, in this expression, it seems everything is well defined. But that's not so, because the square of a delta function is not, strictly speaking, well-defined. You could handle that by regularizing the delta function, for example, by replacing it with a function that is close to being a delta function, but is not quite the Dirac delta, for example, sine x over x, when you peak it sufficiently, or even a Gaussian might do. The main point is that it's a function, and therefore you can write down its square. This really, the delta, what is called the delta function is not a function, it is strictly speaking, a distribution, and we would have to go into distribution theory to handle this term. Fortunately, however, the term drops out anyway, so we don't have to worry about what it might be.
Why did it drop out?
Well, because we take the limit for epsilon going to zero in this. We have 1/ε here, and we have terms that have no power in epsilon, linear in epsilon, quadratic in epsilon. The quadratic term drops out. The terms without epsilon in front cancel each other, and we're left with just a linear term. It's just as always in differentiating. And so we end up being left with this term here. It's just this piece. And you see there's this delta function, which is very nice because it means that we can integrate this integral and obtain that value here. So overall, if you look at it, what we obtain is that the functional derivative of u of y with respect to, of f with respect to u of y gives us this expression here. If you read it from the first line to that line here. So it looks a bit as expected. The quadratic power in u goes away, it becomes linear, we get a factor of 2 in front. Well, and also there is the fact that the integral went away. What if there hadn't been an integral? What then, what would the answer be? That's right, the delta function would still be there because there's no integral to integrate it away, that's all. So you could also differentiate just this expression without the integral. But then you would get, Well, if you don't integrate, then you have to hold x fixed. See, then for every x, you get a function. Okay? Yeah. Okay, but fortunately in physics, we very often have integrals there. And then we get nicer answers like this. Similarly, if you differentiate a functional like this, which is a function times u to the power of n, then the derivative will give us the same type of calculation. F of y times n times u of y to the power of n minus 1, just as one might expect. It's not completely trivial. You should check that really it works out with all the delta functions. So that you just have one delta function left over to get rid of the integral. And that's what will happen. So therefore, we can now functionally differentiate anything that involves a polynomial of a polynomial or if suitable convergence properties hold, then also power series in our variable u. And we see that we can guess immediately what the outcome is. Just like in ordinary differentiation, we don't usually use the Newton-Leibniz limit. We know by heart that this is how differentiation acts. Now, the thing is, did we just invent something new? Or is the functional differentiation really just determined already by ordinary differentiation? Can we derive that from ordinary differentiation? Well, in fact, you can. And the reason is that functional differentiation is a linear operation. And you can do changes of bases in the function space. And they are also linear. So if you have those two linear operations, then you can interchange them. So we worked with functions u of x. But for example, we would have obtained the same result if we used another basis of our function space, either a continuous or a discrete basis of our function space. So for example, another basis, continuous basis, would be the basis of functions e to the power ixp, which is another way of saying that we would work with momentum space representation. So if we have a function such as the one that I wrote down, like this one, then that functional could also be expressed in momentum space, which is through a Fourier transform of the whole thing. You remember that the product of two functions turns into the convolution of those functions, etc. So any functional can also be expressed in a Fourier transformed way. So then the functional depends not on u of y, but it depends on u tilde of w, if w is the frequency variable. And then you could differentiate with respect to u of w. And after you've done that, you could change variables back to the variable that you started out with. And you would get, of course, the same result, because all you've done is you've changed bases in the space of functions. But then these are not the only two choices. When you have a function of x, then you can change bases in the function space by going to the momentum basis. So instead of basis vectors in the function space, which are Dirac deltas peaked at the positions in position space, you could use these basis vectors, e to the power ixp. So those two choices are not the only ones. There's not only the position space, the momentum space representation. There's an infinity of other choices of bases, of course. Every Hilbert space has infinitely many bases. And I think it's worth pointing out that the Hilbert space of square integrable functions, and usually in physics, our function spaces are subspaces of that. You see, we need an inner product in our function spaces usually, and that requires that the functions are in L2. And that's just the usual quantum mechanical inner product space. So the interesting thing I wanted to point out is that the Hilbert space capital L2 of square integrable functions actually also has countable bases, not just the continuous position basis and the continuous momentum basis. It has also discrete bases. For example, you could choose the Hermite functions. Hermite functions are the Hermite polynomials multiplied with Gaussian. Do you remember where they occur in quantum mechanics?
Harmonic.
Yeah, that's right. They're the eigenfunctions to the harmonic oscillator. Or more precisely, they are the eigenfunctions to the Hamiltonian of the harmonic oscillator, which means that they are the eigenfunctions to a self-adjoint operator. And there's a general theorem that says that the eigenbasis to a self-adjoint operator forms a Hilbert basis. You can normalize them. They're going to be orthogonal, and in fact, they're complete. So that means that those guys actually span the entire Hilbert space of square integrable functions. Every square integrable function is a linear combination of such things. Doesn't that look strange? That you can have a continuous basis and a discrete basis for the same function space? Think of a function in position space. It can take an arbitrary value at every point, right? So in order to specify a square integrable function in position space, don't you have to specify at every point x an amplitude? Which means that there is a continuum of information that goes in there, because you have to specify a continuum of amplitudes. Every point x, and there's a continuum of points x, you have to specify an amplitude. So it would seem that to specify a function in position space, you need more information, much more information, than to specify a function given in that basis. Because that's a discrete basis. You need only a countable infinite set of numbers to specify a function when you use this basis. But if you use the position or momentum basis, then you would seem to need an uncountable amount of information to specify those same functions. Any guesses? how that.
So you didn't know that two people in the mind polynomial who just had to say something at the point. Okay. It is a continuous function.
Yeah, but so does this one. You know, these are the basis vectors of momentum states. They're just as well behaved as those are. In fact, they're not simple.
Isn't that what they told Fourier when he came up with the? That won't work because it's.
No, it does work.
Yeah.
The point is this, that the space of square integrable functions, capital L2, is, strictly speaking, not the set of all functions that are square integrable. That's not what it is. Capital L2 is a different thing. Capital L2 is the set of equivalence classes of functions that are square integrable. An element of capital L2 is not an individual function. An element of capital L2 is an equivalence class of functions. And when are two functions equivalent? Well, two functions are called equivalent. I put in the same equivalence class, belong to the same element of capital L2, if they cannot be distinguished under the integral. Right? So that means, for example, that if you take a function f of x and it might look like this, and now let's say it's a continuous function, and now you define a function f hat of x, which looks just like f of x, but at one point, just at one point, its amplitude is this instead of that. Okay, so the two functions differ. They are definitely different functions because at this point, they give you different outputs. Okay? But both f and f hat belong to the same equivalence class of functions in capital L2. They denote the same element in that space. Because if you take f of x or f of f hat of x, so you calculate g of x star f of x dx, then you get the same as if you calculated g star of x f hat of f dx. The integral doesn't notice that single point. In fact, it wouldn't even notice a countable set. Yes?
That's confusing because, like, if you're just talking about like a simple vector space like R3, if what you're saying is almost like if two vectors have the same norm, then they're kind of the same vector.
No, not the same norm. No, that's not what I'm saying. See, this is the same for all G. Right? No matter what G is, the integral is the same.
Yeah, but you can also pick a vector g and then pick some other vector, which is its constant angle around it, and that forms a cone, and then would all those vectors be the same element of, you know what I'm saying? So, sort of.
No, in the vector space, in the Hilbert space, capital L2, they are the same vector.
Okay, that's what I'm confused about, because maybe we can talk afterwards.
Okay, but you see, as functions, they differ. But they're being put in the same equivalence class because under the integral you can't distinguish them. Their inner product with any other vector is the same. Okay, so if capital L2 were the space of our functions that are square integrable, then yes, there would be a problem because the cardinality is different. Countable infinite is much bigger than is much smaller than uncountable infinite, and then the continuum. But that's not what it is. Instead, it's a set of equivalence classes, and it turns out that the cardinality of the basis of that space of equivalence classes is countable infinite. Okay, so but this has now an interesting implication. Namely, what we can do is instead of functionally differentiating in the position basis or in the momentum representation, we can also functionally differentiate in this Permit basis. So we take our functions and write them not in momentum space, but instead we write them as in this basis, which means that every function, or more precisely, every equivalence class of square integrable functions in the capital L2 can be written as a sequence, as a discrete set, as a discrete sequence of numbers, namely the coefficients in this basis of functions. And there are many other countable bases as well, of course. You just take any self-adjoint operator that on functions on the real line that has a completely discrete spectrum. Then its eigenfunctions will form a good basis of the Hilbert space. So you choose one of those discrete bases, and then your function is described by a countable set of coefficients. And you can differentiate with respect to them in the usual way. Just the usual Newton that its limit will do. And you don't need a Dirac delta function, or the Dirac delta distribution. Instead, you can do with just the usual Kronecker delta. And then once you're done, you can change bases back into, for example, the position bases, if that's what you want. So basically, the point of this was to demystify how functional differentiation works. It's just the usual differentiation, but up to a change of basis in the function space. So let us reconsider an example application, namely the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory. Remember how that works? In quantum mechanics, we have degrees of freedom q hat, and we enumerate them by a variable j, which runs from, let's say, for one particle, it runs from 1 to 3. If you have two particles, then you have 6 position operators, and n particles, 3n position operators, etc. And for each of them, you have a momentum operator as well. The variable that enumerates the degrees of freedom we call j, and everything is dependent on time, which we call t. In quantum field theory, we have at every point in space, an operator, self-adjoint operator phi hat, and the conjugate momentum operator pi hat. Here, the operators are labeled by this three-component vector x. In the same way that here, the degrees of freedom were labeled by the discrete variable j. In quantum mechanics, a typical Hamiltonian looks like that, where this is the potential that, for example, depends only on positions. When I drop the index, it means all the variables. Okay? So if it says pj like that here, then yes, we sum over them, etc. And a variable that has no index is just the set of all of them. Then in quantum field theory, we work with this Hamiltonian. Remember that if you take this Hamiltonian and calculate its commutator with, let's say, phi hat, then you get the equation of motion for phi dot, the Heisenberg equation. Regarding the terminology, you see, in quantum mechanics, everything other than this kinetic term is called a potential. In quantum field theory, that's not so obvious. You see, in quantum field theory, you have the pi hat term as well, which is completely analogous to this p hat squared term. But then the rest of it, which generally looks like that, you have this remaining from the D'Alembert operator. Here's the Laplacian. And here's some potential, for example, phi to the fourth power term, something like that, or perhaps an interaction term with another type of field. Well, in principle, if we follow the terminology of quantum mechanics, we should call all of this a potential. But in practice, in quantum field theory, this is what you would call a potential most of the time. And that would be still considered to be part of the kinetic term, even though it doesn't contain time derivatives, it contains space derivatives. So in quantum mechanics, we have a complete set of commuting self-adjoint operators in q hat, and the p hat would do too, but the q hat will do.
So isn't that because phi appears in free fields also?
What do you mean? Are you still referring to?
Yeah, the why the phi does not is not considered part of the potential because phi is there in free field.
What do you mean phi? Phi is here and there too.
No, I mean quadratic terms and phi denote free fields.
Well, that's right. There would not be any interaction in between fields.
There's only phi 4, etc. would describe interaction of fields.
That is right. That is right. So you could put, see the thing is that if you quantize, yes, but you could have a term that is quadratic in phi, but it has also a power, let's say is linear in A, the electromagnetic field. And this way you would describe the interaction of the phi field with the background A field. So just having only quadratic terms in phi doesn't guarantee that the theory is free. You also have to make sure that there are no other fields. In this case, that is so, there are no other fields. So if you drop that term, this doesn't have any other fields, and it's only quadratic, so it's a free field.
That's right.
Yeah, I suppose that's the reason why we would call only that a potential. Just have to make sure that you're not only counting the powers of one type of field, but of all types of fields. Okay, so in quantum mechanics, this would be an example of a complete set of self-adjoint commuting observables. And in quantum field theory, a complete set of self-adjoint operators is given by the phi hat of x, commuting self-adjoint operators, given by that. In quantum mechanics, the joint eigenbasis of a set of a maximal set of commuting observables is very useful because we can use it to write down wave. So the joint eigenbasis of all the position operators in the quantum mechanical theory obeys that those eigenbasis vectors are each characterized by the eigenvalues that they have with respect to all those commuting observables. So if we apply q hat I on one of those joint eigenvectors, then we get the eigenvalue qi in front. So every one of those basis vectors is characterized by a set of numbers, namely the set of eigenvalues with respect to all of those commuting observables. In quantum field theory, very similar. We're looking for a joint eigenbasis of all those operators. And again, a vector in this eigenbasis is characterized by a set of numbers. Namely the eigenvalues with respect to each of those operators here. Now, since this is a continuous set of operators, we have a continuous set of eigenvalues, one eigenvalue for every operator, which you can view as a function. So if we apply the operator phi hat of y onto one of those eigenvectors, then we get the eigenvalue phi of y in front. It's all very similar to what we do in quantum mechanics. It's just that the I run to a discrete set and the y run to a continuous set. The point is that each one of those basis vectors is characterized by a discrete set of numbers, the eigenvalues. And here, each one of those eigenvectors, of those joint eigenvectors, is characterized by a function that tells us for every x what the eigenvalue is. In quantum mechanics, a wave function of an arbitrary vector in a Hilbert space is, when divided in the position eigenbasis, the bracket between that arbitrary vector in the Hilbert space and any one of those basis vectors. That's a complex number here. And that complex number, as a function of the eigenvalues that we're looking for, is the wave function. For example, position wave function, psi of q1, q2, q3. In quantum field theory, we obtain a wave functionality this way.
We take an arbitrary vector in the Hilbert space of pure states. We take our joint eigenbasis of all the phi hat operators. And remember that every basis vector is characterized by giving a function phi of x, a concrete function phi of x. So a wave function now of a state in quantum field theory is the bracket between the arbitrary states that we picked out of the Hilbert space and any one of those basis vectors, where each basis vector is in one-to-one correspondence to a real value function phi of x. And that bracket is, again, a complex number, which we call the wave function now. And what does the probability amplitude mean, this complex number? Well, it's the probability, or the modulus squared of it, is the probability for finding this state if that is the state of the system. So if you prepare the system in that state, then the probability for finding the field in that state is given by the modulus squared of that number. If we measure all those commuting self-adjoint operators, phi hat of x. Yep.
Well, that would be like a probability density.
Yes, of course. It would be probability density.
How about work, though?
Yes, well, you would have to smear this over. You would have to write down something like a wave packet. Right? If you want to do it in a position representation, it's hard because, you know, individually, you just get one number, which for probability density is not a finite probability. So you have to integrate over that space of functions a little bit. You have to do a functional integration over that space of functions. In practice, what you can do is perform all of this, for example, in the momentum representation. When you put an infrared cutoff, because then you're not running through continuous axes, but instead through discrete k. Or, as we just saw above, you can choose another basis as well. You can choose the Hermite function basis, for example, and do everything in the Hermite function basis, where again, your variables here are discrete instead of continuous. And therefore, what you get is really probabilities and not probability density. If you want to work absolutely in the position representation, what you can do, of course, is you can write down, you can specify things in the position representation and transform it into a discrete representation. Perform the calculation there and then bring it back into the position representation. And you see, the point is this state has the property that it is an eigenstate to all of the phi hat operators. And the eigenvalues are given by this function phi of x, which means that this is the probability amplitude density for finding this state, which means for finding these particular values specified by phi of x as the outcome of all those phi hat measurements. So you're performing phi hat measurements at all points x in space at the same time. And at every point in space, you're obtaining a real number as the outcome of that measurement. So overall, your collection of measurement results is a function phi hat of x. And the probability amplitude for finding a particular phi hat of x is given by that calculation. Of course, in practice, as I said before, you can't really go out there and just measure phi hat of x. You don't measure directly the field amplitude. But the field amplitudes are closely related to the energy density, and that has a gravitational effect, which then through redshift, for example, can lead to something observable. Okay, so to simplify notation, because this is really a little bit bulky over there, the set of all phi of x for x in R3, to simplify that notation, in quantum mechanics, we would normally write psi of q and t equal to the bracket of q and psi of t, where q is understood to be the collection of all the position eigenvalues. So we could write this, even though for one particle, this is really q1, q2, q3. In quantum field theory, we can write in a shorthand notation simply psi of phi and t, where phi is understood to be a concrete function phi of x. And this is the probability amplitude for finding a particular function phi of x if the system is in the state psi. And the bracket we write similarly in a short form, simply saying phi. Yeah. And what we mean is the joint eigenvector of all the phi hat operators with eigenvalues given by a function phi of x. Well, then, remember the next thing we wanted to do is get actually to the Schrödinger equation of quantum field theory. And that's where the functional derivatives came in. So in quantum mechanics, we can get a representation of q hat and p on and p hat because they have this commutation relation such that q hat is a multiplication operator, p hat is a differentiation operator. And in quantum field theory, very similarly, we can represent these commutation relations by having phi hat act on a functional like that by multiplying with independent variable, and pi hat of x acting on the functional by through a functional derivative. And using the functional derivatives definition that we had above, you can verify that this representation is really a valid representation of these commutation relations. Then the quantum mechanical Schrödinger equation, which is usually, of course, of this form, in quantum field theory, takes that form. Id by dt, time derivative of the wave function r. And then this is really pi hat squared. And this is really the phi hat acting on this, acting on that. But phi hat acts as multiplication of, on wave functionals. So that's why this takes this simple form here. And here we have some interaction term W of phi. In order to get the Hamiltonian, we integrate this over d3x. And then I made a mistake here. This term is too much because I have it already over here. So this. Okay. See, all of this, all of these are acting on that wave function. This simply being the representation of the Hamiltonian on wave functionals. Now, as you can imagine, if W is anything complicated, and complicated is already phi to the third power or phi to the fourth power, then that cannot be solved explicitly, but perturbatively. If we set W equal to zero, we are back to the free theory. And we could do, for example, a Fourier transform through the momentum variables in the box regularization and then verify that the functional psi naught that we, I wrote down in an early lecture that is supposed to solve this equation here really does. And now you can really verify that using the Newton-Leibniz limit for functional derivatives. Okay, now that we have functional derivatives, we use them for the so-called functional Legendre transform. This is a key mathematical tool that we will need because we will have to answer the following question. What happens to this equation? Remember, on Minkowski space, the momentum, the canonically conjugate momentum to our variable phi was simply phi dot. Very similar to what we had in quantum mechanics. But that just cannot be right in general when we work with general relativity. You see, time is a preferred coordinate in the Hamiltonian formulation, and that's why we have this problem here. In a fully relativistic theory, time is treated just like space, and there is no preferred time coordinate. The formalism has to be coordinate system independent to fit general relativity. And that immediately tells us, even before we introduce anything like curvature, simply the fact that the theory has to be coordinate system independent tells us that this cannot be a general formula. For example, let us assume pi hat is in general simply the derivative of phi, the time derivative of phi. Well, let's say we change variables. We go from one time variable to another time variable that we may call tau. And the new time variable tau may not even be a function of x and t. It may just be a function of t. Tau could be t to the third power. Anything. We're just changing the coordinate system in a fairly trivial way. We just change the time coordinate into time coordinates that's a little bit stretched or squeezed. Well, then, in the new time variable, is that again a valid equation? Well, both cannot be right simultaneously. Because if you calculate what pi hat of x and tau is, well, it is, you know, you get d by dt, phi hat of x of tau and t, that's d by d tau of tau and t times d tau by dt, but just by the chain rule, okay? But that means that it's not the same as d by d tau of phi hat. So we have to make up our minds. Is pi hat to be the t derivative of phi or the tau derivative of phi? And there's an infinity of other possible time coordinates. And more generally, we can mix the time coordinate with the space coordinate. All sorts of things are possible in general relativity because it's a theory that doesn't depend on any choice of coordinate system. So obviously, we'll have to do better than try that because there is no preferred time variable. Therefore, there is no preferred system in which this would be true. So strategy is, first of all, to get the theory into shape in the sense that it should be a theory that it should be in a form that respects relativity right away, that doesn't treat time in any special way. So the strategy is going to be we transform into a coordinate independent Lagrangian formulation. So here's the overall map of what we're going to do next. At the moment, we have a special relativistic formulation, and we do first quantization Hamiltonian way of writing it down. What we will do next is we take the Legendre transform and show that this Hamiltonian formulation of a field theory is completely equivalent to a so-called Lagrangian formulation of the field theory. So we take the Klein-Gordon equation in its Hamiltonian formulation and re-express it in its Lagrangian formulation. Still, it's all just the Klein-Gordon equation at this point, so it's first quantization, and it's special relativity. Now, once we have it in this Lagrangian formulation, the Klein-Gordon equation. We will move on to general relativity. So we still have just the Klein-Gordon equation, not yet the quantum field theory. So we've upgraded the Klein-Gordon equation from a Klein-Gordon equation for special relativity to a Klein-Gordon equation for general relativity. And then we have a choice. We can either go with a reverse Legendre transform to a formulation in which the theory respects the general relativity and has a Hamiltonian form, and then use, as usual, the Heisenberg equations to quantize that theory and go to quantum field theory on curved space. Or we stick to the Lagrangian formulation, which is nice for general relativity, and then immediately go to quantum field theory on curved space. This path is called canonical quantization of quantum field theory. And that path is the Feynman formulation of quantum field theory. And we will show that they are actually the same, that they give us the same predictions. But initially, we'll go that way. And then we'll show that it's equivalent to doing it the Feynman way. So basically, the strategy is we started with the Klein-Gordon equation. And when I mean Klein-Gordon equation, I mean, you know, without quantum field theory. There are no hats on the phi just yet. Just the Klein-Gordon equation, a generalization of the Schrödinger equation. And so far, it's only respecting special relativity. Then we apply Legendre transform to bring it, that was the Klein-Gordon equation in the Hamiltonian formalism. We use the Legendre transform to get it in the Lagrangian formalism. This way, it's fine for general relativity. And then go to general relativity, and then either we go back to a Hamiltonian formulation, which we can quantize, or we go directly to the Feynman formulation. Basically, this side is good for general relativity, and that side is good for quantum theory. And since we have to obey both, we go back and forth. As you see, the Legendre transform is going to be important in this. So what is the Legendre transform anyway? Well, assume you're given a function f of u. Then we can define a new variable w of u, which is the derivative of f. Okay, so we define a new variable w, which is the derivative of f. If the function is what is called convex, as in this case, then if I tell you the value of the derivative, then you can tell where in that function we are. You see, because the derivative is changing, you can pinpoint any location on that graph by specifying a derivative, right? If I say the derivative is 5, then you look, where is the derivative 5? Oh, it's over here. All right, you meant that point, okay? So we assume that the function is actually going to be convex. We define a new variable w of u, which is the derivative. And now we assume that this equation here, w is the derivative of the function, can be solved to obtain u as a function of the derivative. To obtain the position here as a function of the derivative. If the function is convex, so if the second derivative is always larger than zero for all u, then we can do this. Because there's only, for each value of u, there's only one value of the derivative. So there are one-to-one correspondence. The Legendre transform of the function f is now a new function g, which depends on this variable w. The Legendre transform maps f into a function f of u into a function g of w. And g of w is defined to be the new variable times the old variable u expressed as a function of the new variable, because everything has to be a function of the new variable now. So g of w is the new variable times the old variable minus f, the old function, which is a function of the old variable, but it is a function of the new variable. So everything here is a function of the new variable w. That is what the Legendre transform is. Now that might look mysterious to you, right? Is it obvious why that would bring anything good? Not necessarily. But here's some nice properties of it. If you do the Legendre transform twice, you get back where you started, except for minus sign, I should say. Then, well, actually, it depends on how you define it. Yeah, I define it, often it's defined in such a way that you only get back up to minus sign, but the way I define it is you get back exactly the way you started. Here's the proof. Let's say we Legendre transforms to the new function g. Now we define a new variable v of w. So we want to do the Legendre transform over again. We went from a variable u to a variable w. Now we go from a variable w to a variable v, which is the derivative of the function g. Now that was the first step in doing a Legendre transform. And in fact, if we now calculate what v of w is, you go through this calculation here, and you find that v of w actually coincides with the variable that you started out with. That gives us a hint that we might get back to the original function again. At least we get back to the original variable. So the Legendre transform applied twice now gives us the following. From f of u, we went to g of w, and now to h of v. H of v being, as usual for the Legendre transform, the new variable times the old variable minus the old function expressed in terms of the new variable, which is new variable times old variable minus, well, what was g? G was new variable times old variable minus f. And this and that just drops out, and you get f. The thing is that when I was first learning about the Legendre transform, I thought, who would ever dream up such a thing, right? I don't know. And eventually, about 1.5 years ago, I got around to figuring out what this is all about, I think. And I wrote a paper on that, and you may want to look it up on the archive. There are hints about this out there in the literature, and I wrote a paper that tries to bring all things together and add a little bit of new stuff as well. Basically, the point is that the Legendre transform is the infinitesimal version of the Fourier transform. That's what it is. And there is also a geometric interpretation, a graph theoretic interpretation for it. But I can tell you about that only after we've done Feynman rule. All right, but for the moment, you can just think of it as an infinitesimal version of the Fourier transform, even though it may not be obvious why that is so. So now here's an example, just to give you some insight in how it works. Let's say this is our function, what we called capital F before. Function of three variables, A, B, and C. It's this function. Now, let us find the Legendre transform with respect to the variable B. We don't have to Legendre transform with respect to all variables. Let's just do the Legendre transform with respect to a variable B. So we are treating the variables A and C as what we may call spectator variables. They're just dragged along as if they were fixed numbers, okay? Spectator variables. So our function f of A, B, and C, through the Legendre transform, turns into a new function g of A, beta, and C. Beta being the Legendre transform twin of B. What is beta? Well, it's df by db, right? It's the usual method for Legendre transforming. take the function and differentiate with respect to the variable that you operate with, and that gives you the new variable beta. And what is the derivative of f? It's that. Okay? Differentiate this with respect to b, you just get that. Now we have to express the old variable b in terms of the new variable, which we can do. We can express beta in, we can express b in terms of a, c, and beta. Here it is. B, the old variable b, is a function of a, beta, and c, which is 1 over c logarithm of beta over ac. A and c just being spectator variables. Think of them as fixed numbers. Then the Legendre transform of the function little f with respect to the second variable, b, is a function g that depends on a, beta, and c. And g is the new variable times the old variable expressed in terms of the new variables, okay, a, beta, and c, minus the function f that we started with, where the old variable b has to be expressed in terms of the new variable. Because everything here, it depends only on the new variables, a, beta, and c. Everything here just depends on a, beta, and c. So we can plug everything in here. We know what beta is. I mean, beta is its own variable. And b of a, beta, and c is what we have here. That's just that. And then we can express f, this thing here, in terms of a, c, and b expressed in terms of the new variables as well. That just gives us this. So overall, that's what it is. So that is the Legendre transform of that function f with respect to the second variable. Now what if we have not just three variables, but countably many variables? How then would we define the Legendre transform of a function of countably many variables to give us a new function capital G? And we want a Legendre transform with respect to all of the variables, let's say. Well, we define the new variables W to be the derivative of F with respect to the old variables U. We have to assume multidimensional convexity so that we can invert that function to obtain U of W, to be able to express the old variables in terms of the new variables. By the way, about this convexity business here, the thing is that in the paper that I wrote, I showed that you don't really need that convexity thing. The convexity assumption, if you do this algebraically, you see differentiations and operations like the ones that we do here. You can also define term by term for former power series. And it turns out that if you define these things in this purely algebraic way, not an analytic way, using Newton-Leibniz derivatives, but algebraic derivatives, then you can actually drop that condition of convexity. It's replaced by something a little bit weaker than convexity.
That's right. Yes, you're replacing convexity by local convexity. You only need it at a point. Or more precisely, at an infinitesimally small neighborhood around it. Okay, so now let's assume that we can invert this to obtain the new variables in terms of the old variables in terms of the new variables. Then we can define the Legendre transform function, this thing here, to be given by the new variables times the old variables expressed in terms of the new variables minus the old function where its arguments are expressed as functions of the new variables, so that everything depends only on the new variables. On top of that, we could have spectator variables, but in this case, we just Legendre transform with respect to everything. So how about the case of uncountably many variables? Well, this is where it comes in handy that we did the functional derivative. So how to define now the Legendre transform of a functional of functions? And you can think of u of x as being
a collection of variables that are labeled by a discrete label x, where x is an element of Rn. But you can also think of this, of course, as being a map from function z of x into real numbers or complex numbers. Either way, the Legendre transform has got to be a new functional that depends on new variables. So now we define the new variables, w of x, as the functional derivative of f with respect to the the old variable u of x. And I'm talking, of course, in that terminology where we view u of x as a collection of variables, one variable u for each choice of label x. We again assume that we can resolve this equation so that we get the old variables, u, as explicit expressions in terms of the new variables, w. If we can do that, then we can define the Legendre transform g. The Legendre transform g depends only on the new variables, and is given by the sum over all of the new variables times all of the old variables. The old variables expressed in terms of the new variables. Remember, this is very similar to what we had here. And we Legendre transformed a countable set of variables. Then we had the Legendre transform here, g, was the sum of all the new variables times the old variables. We had a sum because we did so many Legendre transforms. Right? If we did Legendre transform with respect to only one variable and all others would be considered spectator variables, then there wouldn't be a sum. But for every variable, we do a Legendre transform and therefore we get the sum of all those terms. So similarly, in the continuous case, we obtain that we have here that the Legendre transform g is the sum of all the new variables times the old variables being expressed in terms of the new variables. And I'm saying sum, but of course, in the continuous case, that turns into an integral. And we differentiate and we subtract from that, as usual, the function that we started out with all of its old variables expressed as functions of the new variables. And then you can show that indeed, even for that Legendre transform, we still have that if you apply it twice, you get back to where you started. It's an involution. Let us apply the Legendre transform to classical mechanics first. Let us assume the Hamiltonian of the classical theory is given as an explicit function in Q and P. The Hamiltonian equations for arbitrary for an arbitrary function f of q and p, that is the classical version of what in quantum mechanics are the Heisenberg equations of motion, is this, of course. The time derivative of any expression in q and p is always the Poisson bracket between f and h. Remember that the Poisson bracket between q and p is 1. In quantum mechanics, that is still true. And we have that the Poisson bracket between Q and P hat is equal to 1 over IH bar, the commutator of Q hat and P hat. So in quantum mechanics, the Poisson bracket is represented as a commutator. Anyway, in classical mechanics, one can then prove the equations of motion for Q and P, namely that Q dot is dH by dP and P dot is minus dH by dQ. In fact, if you want to prove this in classical mechanics, it is useful to go all the way and to prove that in classical mechanics, this is quantum mechanics, in classical mechanics, Q and P, or F of Q and G of P is dF dQ dG dP minus dG dQ dF dP. I'm sure you've seen that. And from that, you can see right away that these two equations of motion hold. But that's just a review. Now, the Legendre transform in classical mechanics gets us from the Hamiltonian, which is a function of the variables Q and P, to a new function, which is called the Lagrangian, depending on two variables Q and B. So the Legendre transform that we apply here treats Q as a spectator variable, and the Legendre transforms only with respect to the P variable. Concretely, B, the new variable, is, by the usual rules of Legendre transform, B has got to be the derivative of H with respect to P. But what is the derivative of H with respect to P? Well, we have it over here. It happens to be an equation of motion, and it's Q dot, which means that, it, as it happens, the new variable B coincides with Q dot. But in principle, it's a new variable. So the Lagrangian of Q and B is the Lagrangian of Q and Q dot. It's the new variable times the old variable, where the old variable P is expressed in terms of Q and Q dot, minus the old function, which is H of Q, and now this is an old variable, we have to express it in terms of the new variables Q and Q dot. Then there's this proposition. The equations of motion now take this form. So the claim is that when we start with classical mechanics in this formulation, where we have a Hamiltonian and the equations of motion are given by those two equations, then after we do a Legendre transform, we can write the same two equations as one equation, namely the Euler-Lagrange equation here. And I leave it to you as an exercise to prove that this is so, that the two Hamiltonian equations of motion give you this Euler-Lagrange equation and vice versa. So for example, the Hamiltonian in classical mechanics of a harmonic oscillator looks like this, and its equations of motion are those. If we do the Legendre transform for the variable P, then we obtain the Lagrangian for the variables Q and beta, where beta turns out to be Q dot. That's one of the equations of motion. And the other equation of motion is this one. And one can show that these are equivalent. But please try it out for arbitrary potentials. So now let's do the real thing. Let's do it for quantum field theory, for classical field theory, and then for quantum field theory. So CFT will stand for classical field theory. Of course, in the literature, you also get CFT standing for conformal field theory, but that's not what we mean. It's classical field theory as opposed to quantum field theory. So let us assume for this that the Hamiltonian of our field theory is given. The field theory could be the Klein-Gordon field theory, for example, but not yet quantized, just the relativistic generalization of the Schrödinger equation, just the Klein-Gordon field, Klein-Gordon equation, and the phi doesn't have a hat on it just yet. So we assume the Hamiltonian H of phi and pi is given, and the Hamiltonian equation for an arbitrary expression in phi and pi is then this. Equation of motion for an arbitrary expression, And of course, for f, we can choose phi to get the equation of motion for phi. For f, we can choose pi and get its equation of motion. The Poisson bracket between phi and pi is, as usual, like that. And this gives us these equations of motion. Phi dot is that expression. Pi dot is this expression. Very similar to what we had in classical mechanics. Now we do Legendre transform. The Legendre transform gets us from the Hamiltonian in terms of the field and its conjugate momentum field to the Lagrangian in terms of the field and a new variable rho, where rho is the Legendre twin of pi. And concretely, we can see what that is. Well, rho is, by the definition of the Legendre transform, rho has got to be dh by d phi. So it's dh by d pi, because we are Legendre transforming with respect to pi. But dh by d pi is, by the equations of motion that we have up here, just phi dot. So the Legendre transform is a function of phi and phi dot. And it is concretely the integral over the new variable, phi dot, or which we may also call beta or rho, the new variable times the old variable, the old variable pi expressed in terms of the new variables, phi and phi dot. And we sum over all of them, of course, the sum over all new variables times the old variables, minus the old function h, where in h we have to express the old variable pi in terms of the new variables phi and phi dot. And then the proposition is that the equations of motion that we had in the Hamiltonian formulation are completely equivalent to the so-called Euler-Lagrange equations. But we have the functional derivative of L, the Lagrangian, with respect to phi, time derivative of the functional derivative of L with respect to phi dot. Again, I hope that you can check that. In fact, I hope that most of you have seen this before. And if you have not seen this before and you find that this was a little bit too fast, then do let me know and I take some time and show you more details if you want them. Okay, an example would be this. We take the Hamiltonian of the free Klein-Gordon field, and we obtain that phi dot is pi, I dot is this. Overall, we get the Klein-Gordon equation. Now we do the Legendre transform and obtain that the Lagrangian is this expression, which looks very similar to the Hamiltonian, right? The main difference is what? You see, even the pi dot here is the same as the phi dot, except that I forgot the square. Very similar, right? What's the only, I mean, there's only just one difference here. There's a minus sign here where we have a plus sign over there. Other than that, it's very similar. And this Euler-Lagrange equation gives us the Klein-Gordon equation right away. Now you may wonder, why on earth did we go through all this trouble? Didn't we just see phi dot being pi again? And didn't we just say that this is a bad definition? Well, the thing is, we did this transformation, this is a Legendre transform in Minkowski space. So there's no curvature just yet. And also we've used Cartesian coordinates and so on. So we worked within special relativity and reformulated now the theory of the Klein-Gordon field in terms of the Lagrangian of it, instead of using the Hamiltonian. The point is that the Lagrangian formulation will allow us to move to general relativity very nicely. It's perhaps not as easy to quantize a theory in its Lagrangian formulation. However, it's much easier to move the theory from special relativity to general relativity. So this is still special relativity, but the next thing we'll do is use this as a starting point and then generalize to general relativity.
using the Lagrangian formula?
Well, because as we will see, the Lagrangian formalism will treat time on the same footing as space, and it will allow a description of the theory that does not depend on the choice of coordinates. Whereas in the Hamiltonian formulation, you always have the Hamiltonian being a special thing. It's the generator of translations in time. So you single a particular time variable. And so by going to the Lagrangian formalism, we can avoid that. We can treat space and time on the same footing and allow and obtain a description of the theory that is completely equivalent in whatever coordinate system you may choose. So then we have achieved a general relativistic generalization of the Klein-Gordon theory. But then, of course, we haven't done quantum field theory. This is just the Klein-Gordon field, just the relativistic version of the Schrödinger equation. So then we still have to second quantize it. And for that purpose, as I said, there are two routes that we can take. We can either say, OK, once we have it in the general relativistic formulation, using the Lagrangian machinery, then we move back to the Hamiltonian formulation. After all, we are already within general relativity. So we then move it back to the Hamiltonian formulation, where it is straightforward to do the quantization. And that's what we will do, of course. In this way, we will end up with a theory that is both general relativistically covariant and quantized. Well, or once we have the theory in its Lagrangian general relativistic formulation, we can aim straight for the goal and second quantize that. We will also do this. This will be the final quantization. The trouble, though, is that for the purpose of studying quantum field theory in cosmology, the Hamiltonian formulation is more useful because it is more appropriate for studying the properties of the vacuum and the excitation of the harmonic oscillators that are involved and things like that. For the purpose of studying quantum field theory in particle physics, it is usually easier to work with a Feynman formulation, with a Feynman particle equation, which will recover too, but not as much as the Hamiltonian formulation. Okay. Any questions? We're quite a bit over time today, but I suppose we started. Another thing that came to mind is, you know, we have one.